Hey, this is Dominique Henderson, your CFP on YouTube, helping you jumpstart your career in financial services. As always, I'm bringing to you fresh ideas from a recently aired video on my YouTube channel, which you can find at www.youtube.com/theYouTubeCFP. Do me a favor, my friend, and text me at 214-699-7599 with any questions you might have from this show so I can help you along your journey in becoming a successful financial professional. Again, that number is 214-699-7599. All right, let's hop into today's topic.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, you should, you know, be a professional. Think about this as a profession. And you want to be world-class at what you do.
Yeah.
Right. And so, so developing world-class skills and habits and in concert of developing a business. So if you wanted to think of yourself like I want to be an Olympian at this, right? And so Olympians treat their craft a certain way.
What's up, everyone? This is Dominique Henderson, your CFP on YouTube. And that was just a taste of what you have in store for this Conversations in Finance with my friend and guest, Wilson Muskinen of the Money Speak Easy. He is a financial coach, and we broke down the financial profession, specifically relating to financial coaching, really well in what you're about to watch. But we always start with my guest's money story. And just a spoiler alert on Wilson, he's got book reports, free t-shirts, and Bulls championships all inside of his money story. Take a look.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think my money story, most people's money story starts with their parents. Start with that. My parents are both Caribbean immigrants. I grew up in Chicago. I was born in the U.S. I grew up in Chicago in the 80s and 90s. So I grew up during the Michael Jordan Bulls era. So
great
just winning championships, man. Every year, doing that thing. So, the reason I bring up my parents, specifically my father, is that we had money conversations from jump. Right. Mm. So the way that I started learning about money was from him. And he had a non-traditional way to go about it. I didn't know it was non-traditional at the time, but he was more he didn't believe in paying you to do things that you were supposed to do. So I didn't get like an allowance for chores or anything.
Sounds like my parents.
Right. It's like I'm not paying you to do stuff you're supposed to do. That doesn't make any sense. So but my allowance came from reading books and writing book reports on the books that he assigned.
Okay.
Right. And so the reason I bring that up is because some of those books were personal finance books. And so I was reading things like Rich Dad, Poor Dad and Think and Grow Rich as like a preteen. Rick Edelman, I remember back in the day reading his stuff back in the day. And so, but I had to write the book reports on that, and that would start our conversations about money. And I actually started to like it to the point where I was reading books that he didn't even assign. Right. And so, I didn't realize that was really weird until I got to college.
So how old are you? When did you go to college? Let me get context.
I went to college in the late 90s, early 2000s. So at that time in college, there was still those, the tables at the cafeteria where they were giving out credit cards and handing out free t-shirts and hats if you signed up for a credit card.
This is pretty much pre-internet.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I was just on the precipice before, like we're just getting email addresses and stuff.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, that's when that started to happen. And so suddenly my classmates started getting credit cards. Stuff just like people were acting crazy. And I couldn't understand why people were, buying pizza and clothes and
gotta get that free t-shirt for the credit card, man.
Right. But using credit card and just in ways that I just didn't understand. And right. And so you don't know people's backgrounds in terms of like whether their parents are paying for the credit card or whatnot. But like,
yeah.
But it just didn't make any sense to me to like be spending on stuff when you didn't have a job or didn't have income. Like it didn't resonate with me. And so I didn't know how to have conversations with people about that stuff. And so, but I knew I was interested in having those conversations and helping people with their finances.
Now, Wilson experienced what I feel is an all too familiar instance with how he found out about financial advising in at least his first interview. And this is the reason why I always advocate research first as the core component before you enter this industry. You need to learn about the different types of firms and channels that are out there. But this is what Wilson had to say about his first experience.
So I wanted to be, graduating college, I got a business degree. I wanted to be a financial advisor. And that was not.
We talked about this a little bit. Was this the interview with the representative that shall go unnamed?
So just quickly on that, it was. I thought I wanted to be a financial advisor. I'm sitting in an interview. This guy is interviewing me, and he's just totally disinterested in anything that I had to say.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm a 6'6" black guy. Like, I'm walking into these financial firms. If, you know, guys is interested, I'm like, all right, he's just not feeling me. He doesn't think I can do this, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, move on. So I'm going through the motions, but suddenly he asked me a question that I never been asked before. You know, like, you're getting ready for interviews. Like, you had your list of questions and you've thought this all out in advance.
Yeah.
And suddenly he asked me, like, what do your parents do? And I'm like, So I just
answered. What does it have to do with the interview?
Exactly. So I said to him, I said, yeah, well, my father's a physician and my mom's a nurse and she runs my dad's private practice. And then all of a sudden his whole demeanor changed. He looked up at me for the first time in the interview, actually looked away from his computer, turned his body, looked at me and started asking. And he started talking as if I already had the job. He was like, you know, I started talking like, all right, one of the first things we're going to need you to do when you start is to, you know, make a list of all your parents, your friends.
Oh, yes. And so, the whole life pitch.
Yeah.
to and all so, your friends and family.
I was like, back up, you know, down, hold. So that to me felt really slimy. And so I didn't have a language to understand why that didn't feel comfortable or, but for me, I was very turned to financial advising. And I didn't, it's not to demean financial advisors. It just felt, it didn't feel like the right fit for me.
Next, we dove into the topic of incentives. There's been a lot of talk around the incentives of financial advisors for those that are looking to consume financial services. So we kind of broke down that subject of incentives and what it really means to consumers of financial services as well as providers of financial services. Take a look.
I give that story to say that not to demean financial advisors. I mean, clearly in any industry, there's slimy folks. But for me, what I learned from that is that it's all about incentives. Right. At the end of the day, we do what we're incentivized to do. And I feel like that there were that there are it's changing, as you said, that there are incentives within the industry that that act against the consumer's interest. Right.
And so name some of those. So, they may seem obvious to people like us, but for anyone that's watching this, that's a newbie in the industry, since a large part of my audience are career changers and or people that are in their first, let's call it 2-3 years of finding this out. And for any consumers of financial services that are watching it, what are some of the incentives that, you know, keep the, let's call it the end objective of helping the client, you know, kind of too far off in the distance that needs to be probably right in front of our face?
Yeah. So there is an asymmetry of information that goes on where, you know, even the disclosure of how you're getting paid and who is paying you. Yep. Is an asymmetry of information. So so let's give the example of like a mortgage broker, right? Mm-hmm. So a mortgage broker is paid by a bank, right? That's giving out loans. And so for that person to be telling you how much you can afford for a house, that's not the person that you want to
conflict
go to
of interest.
Because there's a conflict of interest, right? And so, so to me, there are incentives in place that create a clear conflict of interest in terms of if you're not directly paying that person for their advice and solely for their advice, and they're not getting paid by the other, and they're getting paid by the other side, that creates a conflict. If they're getting paid by more than the other side, then they're getting paid by you, or just the mere fact that they're getting paid by both sides creates a conflict.
I agree. And I think the way, just to interject here, I think you raise a great point, and it's been, it's been somewhat philosophical in this industry for, let's call it, the last 7 years with this whole fee only versus fee based. I used to be totally fee only. I changed the fee based. And I think you raise a great point. I think the number one thing to do is to identify what that conflict is, make sure the client totally understands what it is and how you're going to circumvent it. Right. And if it's from a compliance standpoint, as long as you document it in the industry, you're good to go. For instance, this is a great example. I was speaking with a prospective client the other night, and I listed out all the type of ways I'm going to get paid. So there's going to be a upfront fee for doing your plan. Mm-hmm. There's going to be an assets under management fee for managing your assets, depending on how much you want to transfer over. Mm-hmm. And there may be an issue where I review your insurance policies and I recommend something. Mm-hmm. The insurance company is going to pay me outside of what you pay me. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure that you're okay with that.
Absolutely.
And then get them to acknowledge that and sign off on or whatever your policies are. And then don't keep them from making a business decision because you've withheld information, which is the whole asymmetry of information that you're talking about, correct?
And that's my point.
Now, Wilson and I agree that as practitioners, providers of financial services, we have a money story to tell also. We have something that is very personal to us about money, and that influences the type of advice we give. So as an aspiring financial professional, you have to explore that. And this is what Wilson and I were talking about when it came to that.
Do you maybe think that if you've come from somewhat of a weird money story background that you haven't fully unpacked, that then you lend yourself to walking down these roads that you probably shouldn't walk down with a client?
Yeah, yeah. So a poor financial advisor or a poor financial coach is not a great situation.
Yeah, in other words. Yeah.
But yes, I do think that your own personal financial situation does impact the advice that you give. You could have the best of intentions, but like you said, if you're having trouble putting food on the table, like that influences the decisions that you make. You don't have to be, you know, the super wealthy, financial advisor, and you don't have to, have, crazy looking, crazy cars or whatnot in order to have to get good advice. And probably that works in the inverse, right? But yeah. You do want to have a financial, you do want to work with people that have their stuff together, right? That aren't necessarily doing this for the first time or, that kind of thing, that have some kind of cachet enough to be able to give you the advice that you need, and that you know that you have reasonable comfort and trust that what they're saying is in your best interest and not theirs.
Next, we dove into barriers to entry in this particular industry, especially as opposed to or in comparison to other industries like lawyers or doctors. And just an alert, I'll let you know that we pontificated just a bit, but it was still some great information exchange.
What's your opinion on the current standard for becoming a financial advisor? Do you think it's too low?
So becoming a financial advisor...
Yeah, being actually able to give financial advice with, like right now. I mean, I have a pretty, hard right opinion about this, that the barrier is too low. I think it's it lends itself to the wrong people getting into this industry, especially when you think about the magnitude of some of the decisions that they influence people to have.
I absolutely agree. But I would also have to look inward and say that the barrier for financial coaching is non-existent, right? And so,
okay. Yeah. So
I have to be fair both ways.
Yeah.
But as far as financial advising is concerned, think about the barriers to entry for a lawyer, for an attorney, right? And so, and this is how I think about when I talk about information asymmetry.
Yeah.
I would love to get to the point where, from a society, from a governmental standpoint, from an economic standpoint, that you have the availability to have an advocate when you make these large financial decisions.
Yeah.
Right. And so you're walking into a dealership to buy a car. Before you sign papers, you should have the availability of somebody to be able to look over that and say, this is or is not a good financial deal for you.
Yeah.
And somebody that is either paid by you or is an advocate for you in that transaction, right? Because that framework doesn't currently exist, and so that's particularly buying a house. Like those things that realtor is not necessarily, you know, they're on both sides of the transaction as well. And so their incentives are not necessarily always aligned to your direct interest. And so I also think there needs to be advocates in that situation. So that, so if you think about the lawyer model and everything for them, they have to do everything in your best interest. And we basically talking about the fiduciary standard. That those kinds of relationships, I think, should go down the line, not just for investments, but also for large financial transactions as well.
It is.
But I do think there's a new generation coming, right? And there's a new generation that has different demands that is going to demand transparency. That's going to demand these kinds of things. So it will evolve, and I hope we do get to that one body. Conversations like this and conversations that we're having with others are going to get us to that place. So I do think it's important that we have one centralized body and standards across that the 15 steps that I was talking about in terms of that financial journey and progression, that there are standards across that and across the industry.
No, I agree, because you know the fact that you can have an alphabet soup of financial designations right now, I think, is ludicrousy also.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, I mean, there's so much confusion for the person that's looking for just someone to help me, and they have to look in all these different spots. I can see how they just get, you know, information fatigue or data fatigue and just say, I'll just do it myself. And then that lends itself to the problem.
And I like to compare it to other industries. So like, you know, like I brought up nurses, for example. Mm-hmm. Imagine if there were different bodies that were regulating who could be a nurse and what that type of nurse meant.
Like, it'd be crazy.
Either you're a registered nurse or you're not. Like, I don't, it can't be like, you know, you're a registered nurse with this nursing association, or you're, you know, I can't come up with another name for a nurse, a registered caretaker with this.
Exactly.
Like, no. Like, either you're,
exactly,
you're supposed to be here in this hospital to take care of my, you know, my health needs, or you're not. There needs to be a standard or level of care, right? Like, just if you think about like hospitals, like regardless of where you are, like there's a standard of care for nurses, right? There's a standard of care, like there needs
clean to be floors basic, when you come in, right?
Exactly. So there just needs to be a standard of care and a methodology. I don't know in terms of like the specifics of how to go about it, but I do think there needs to be an exam involved, you know, possibly an interview, possibly some.
What do you think? So this has been always a big consternation of mine, and I know why it doesn't happen, which I'll reveal in just a little bit for everybody that's like, really, you know why it doesn't happen? Like, I think we need a uniform body. Like, if you look at other areas, Australia is a good example. Actually, the UK is a good example, too, where there's one unified bottle. There's not like three or four. It's not the SEC and FINRA, you know, all these SROs, self-regulatory organizations. Yeah. They're not there with all their silos of exams they give you and things that they can organize and all this kind of stuff. They're just one body that says, this is how it's going to be. If you want to be a financial advisor or a financial professional, you need to go through us. There are no ways to circumvent, but in the US, there are. There's like several bodies.
In this next segment, Wilson broke down his interpretation of the continuum of financial services. And I really, really like this. So make sure you pay really close attention.
But okay. I do believe that there does need to be a demonstration of a level of knowledge and experience that you can measure, right? Financial coaching and financial advising are very different in terms of their their end goal, right? Their the way that I describe a financial coach is almost a pre-financial advisor, right? And so the way that I look at it is on a scale of like 1 to 15, I would say that 1 being you know, broke, just got out of high school or college, you're just about to get your first job, to 15 being financially independent. I would say the vast majority of people are dealing with steps 1 through 10, right? And so, and by vast majority, I mean over 80% of the population.
Yeah.
Right. And the financial,
not the 80% of the wealth, if you will, or income, but of the numbers of people. I totally agree.
80% of the population in terms of numbers, right?
Yep.
But the financial services industry is completely designed and incentivized to serve you in terms of dealing with steps 11 through 15. right?
With probably the 20% of wealth, the top 20% of wealth that's there to manage.
Correct.
Focusing on that at least. Yeah, I agree. Hey, Dominique here, and I hope you are really enjoying this week's episode. Look, if you're a current or aspiring financial professional and you'd like to join a community of like-minded individuals that I'm sharing my 20 plus years of experience with, make sure you visit my website at www.djh-capital.com for more information. Now back to this week's episode. Now, as you know, I've only been a financial advisor. I've never been a financial coach. And I wanted Wilson to give us some insight as to what a day in the life, how he deals with clients, what it looks like, what questions is he asking, the type of experiences he's taking clients through as a financial coach. And this is what he had to say about that.
Yeah, so I think similar to a financial advisor, financial coaching is a referral type of business. Right. Your clients, your current clients are your biggest advocates in terms of getting you more clients and your ability to serve others. You can market as much as you want and put yourself out there, but people have to, we're talking about people's money. Right. And so there is an intimate relationship. And oftentimes when I talk about money, I'll say to folks like, it is more likely that your best friend knows more about your sex life than they do about your money, right? And so you have to be cognizant about how intimate that relationship is for somebody to trust you with their financial details that potentially their spouse or their close family members and friends don't even know. And so there is a big onus on you to conduct yourself in a way or project yourself in a way that inspires trust, inspires confidence and that kind of thing. So a day in the life, I think one of the important things for coaches is that to understand the coach aspect of the coach, right? Mm-hmm. It is not something where you have this great system, you have this, this great debt payoff story. And now all of a sudden you're a great coach. It is, being a great coach or being a financial coach is about listening. It's about allowing your client or asking your client the pertinent questions to get them to find the answer for themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And not necessarily dictating because I know the answers. I'm going to tell you this, that, and the other. So there's much more of a counseling aspect to it. And because really at the end of the day, let's be really frank. When you're talking about the early aspects, when you're talking about, budgeting, debt, savings, credit, those kinds of things, it's not rocket science. There's nothing, scientific about it or super complex. We're not using the crazy terms that they use on the financial advising side to obfuscate and create confusion, right? Like these are very simple terms. Like, here's a budget, here are your expenses, your net income. Let's talk about that. So we don't have that sort of cloud of confusion. And everybody knows, like, it's almost like health. We know with our health, drink water, eat vegetables, exercise. But there's a difference between knowing that and actually performing that behavior. So as a coach, you're trying to inspire behavior change and habit creation. So I spend most of my time, with clients trying to understand their motivations, their passions, their behaviors, and trying to, tap into them. To be able to change those behaviors by understanding, who they are and what they really want.
I wanted Wilson to give me what he felt are the most essential skills as a financial professional, whether you're going to be an advisor or a coach. And this is what he had to say.
Yeah, so I'll talk about two skills. So the skill of EQ on a scale of 1 to 10, like EQ is 10, right? Like you're not paying me as a coach to tell you to spend less money, right? Like, you can do that on it's not hard. Like you can, most people or anybody that would work with me has the ability to take their income, subtract their expenses and say, okay, this needs to go out. This needs to go out.
Yeah.
What you're paying me for is to be able to be your accountability partner, to be able to be your coach, to be able to influence you, help you change your behavior. Because you recognize that there is a behavior change that is necessary in order to get to for your goals. So what I tell my clients all the time is, I'm not here to tell you what to do with your money. You worked hard for that money. That is for you to decide what to do. My role is to be a mirror of your values. At the end of the day, all I want you to do is take a look at your bank statement, and I will ask you a simple question. Does your bank statement reflect your personal values and goals? If the answer to that question is no, let's do some work, right? Let's get so that you're spending the most on what's most important to you and the least on what's least important to you. So as a coach, my job is to help you reflect your personal values in terms of how you allocate your resources that you worked hard for. It is not about me. It's not about what I think, what I want to do. It's about making sure that the way you allocate your resources is with your priorities and goals. And that's why you're paying me as a coach.
Yeah. I often say that financial planning obviously is not about the math. It's more about how do I take, you know, limited resources, time and money, and allocate them across unlimited choices. Because unless you have somebody like a professional like us to help you articulate what your goals are, then it seems like things are unlimited. Like to me though, I don't have unlimited choices. I know very specifically what I'm trying to accomplish, but it's been through some work to do that. And even with that, I have a professional helping me make sure I stay true to that. Just because as much knowledge as I have, it still doesn't really keep me from making, you know, the mistakes that you make when you're biased with your own money. But the point of that being is, if you don't have a coach or a guide to help you articulate these things, it seems like the world's your oyster and you will definitely probably make some bad choices. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And I say it in a slightly different way. I use this affirmation with my clients all the time. And part of it is that money is a valuable resource that you use to support things that are invaluable, like your family, your time, and your talent.
Yep.
Right. And so you're taking this finite resource and you're using it to support things that are invaluable to you. And so that's what I think the purpose of money is in general. We put all kinds of, labels and emotion and thing about things around money, and we give it value and power over us and all this kind of thing. But if we think about it as just a resource like water, like fire, that supports things that we think that are invaluable to us, like our family, our time, and our talent, that way, that is a way that we can use to prioritize how we allocate our resources.
Now, I don't want to leave you hanging. If you're really, really intrigued by what you're listening to in this interview, I wanted Wilson to give us some really tangible ways that a person interested in financial coaching could really break into this industry. And this is what he said.
Yeah, so I would say a couple things. I would say, first off, do not quit your full-time job and decide just on a whim that you want to become a financial coach.
Thank you for
number
saying
one,
that.
all day, every day. So, again, going back to our earlier conversation, a financial coach in a bad financial position is not a good financial coach, right?
Correct.
And that would be my second thing that I'd recommend is that if you're inkling or thinking about getting into this lane, let's start saving above and beyond your 3 to 6 month emergency fund. Give yourself a long, long runway to be able to sort of figure this out, build your client base and that kind of thing. So you don't get in that situation where you have, that commission breath.
Yeah.
So you want to position yourself for that. So if you're looking into this, see this as a longer term deal. That's going to be 2, 3 to 5 years for you to actually really get good at it.
Yeah.
The other thing is that to think about this as a craft, as a skill, almost like you're an athlete, right? And so I happen to be 6'6". Just because I'm 6'6" doesn't make me a good basketball player, right? I would have to develop the skill of being a basketball player. So there's a skill around financial coaching or coaching in general, talking with people about their money and helping them make different decisions, helping them realize their own shortcomings and that kind of thing, and influencing them to, as I said, mirror their values with their spending, right? And so that takes time. Those are things that are skills, the EQ that we talked about that needs to be developed over time. So the way that I would think that's tangible to be able to do that, number one, do look for those organizations that are potentially hiring part-time coaches, for example. start building your own craft. Look at the some of the accreditation organizations. So I think one is you go to the National Financial Education Educators Council as mm-hmm. one. The AFCPE is another. Yep. If you want to get the AFC designation, look into some of those things to start to understand how, even though it's not universally standardized, at yeah. least look into, you know, ways that they are setting some standards so that you're communicating in the right way. You're communicating in a way that is at least thought of as a proper way to communicate with clients within the industry. And again, start developing that craft of coaching. Start developing your own craft in terms of your knowledge. There are knowledge areas that you're not, you know, you're not familiar with. So dive into those areas. And the last thing I would say is start to join, you know, financial coaching communities, whether it's the, you know, Jumpstart like yours, or even, you know, online Facebook groups of financial coaches, and understand the business of financial coaching. Right. Start to learn about that. Ask questions of other financial coaches and get involved in a community of other people that are doing it so that you can learn along the way and so that it can curb your the learning curve a little bit. Yeah. Right. And so if you're learning from others and get sort of a mentor that's a financial coach and that kind of thing, it can curb that the steep learning curve, and that you can get into this for the right reasons and do it the right way. Because at the end of the day, you're going to want to build systems and processes. A business is just a, you know, formal systems and processes to generate profit at the end of the day. And so if you don't have any of those systems, you're sort of just winging it. That's not a business. That's just an expensive hobby. Yeah. And so those are some of the tangible things that I would recommend in terms of how to start thinking about the financial coaching and getting your feet wet while not quitting your job and then jumping right in.
Absolutely. I would also add that volunteering, I mean, you got Jumpstart Coalition, you got Sensibility, you've got, I just said Junior Achievement. These are ways that I think these are more closely aligned with financial coaching because they have the economic empowerment, financial literacy component that is so, to me, as a core skill to being a financial mm-hmm. coach. Where a lot of people, I get it. They don't, they're like, hey, I don't got time to volunteer, but I'm like, you got to make time. You got to find a way to do it.
Well, just like with money. I mean, if you're coaching people to prioritize their finances, like, you know, I call a budget a to-do list for your money. Right. And so I would say you would prioritize your time in the same way. You're allocating your time based on your priorities. And so, you know, if you don't have the time to do it, that means that it's not a priority.
By definition. Yeah. That's a really simple way to say it.
I know you were waiting for it. And here it is, the lightning round. This is what Wilson and I talked about in the lightning round.
Financial coaching is just as important as health and fitness, right? You know, it should be a mainstay. Like, I should be able to call somebody and have a conversation about these big financial decisions I'm making. Just like if you were trying to get in shape and you wanted to get a personal trainer or a nutritionist, like, you want to have a conversation with somebody about that. Like, how should I do it for me personally, my individual situation?
Yep. In what order should I do the thing so I don't do the seventh thing first?
Exactly.
No, I love that. If asked of one of your clients, what has been the impact of financial coaching in your life, what would they say?
I would go back to what I said before in terms of having that mirror. My financial coach reflected to me what my priorities were, what I made time for, right? What my priorities were based on my spending, right? And when I saw that picture, I didn't like it. And so we worked together to make sure that when I saw that mirror of my bank statement, I liked what I saw in the mirror. And that reflected my own personal values.
Excellent. Excellent.
So you would need to understand your own internal motivation. Is it about you? Is it about being, you know, a face that's out there and you want to be a personality and project something to people? Or is it about the people that you're serving, right? Is it about being able to change people's financial trajectory? And is that really it? You have to be honest with yourself, like honest at the end of the day. Like, do you really care about, you know, being on phone conversations late at night, you know, after you come back from work, about somebody's budget, right? About, you know, how much they spent on X, Y, and Z. Is that something that you really want? So asking yourself and being truly honest. Nobody's in the room. You can just have a very honest conversation about yourself. Like, do I really care about how people are, you know, spending their money, doing this and that? Or do I want to appear as though I am this, you know, I'm all knowledgeable financial person that is that's doing well and doing great? So, like, be honest with yourself about why you're going after it and why you're in it. Or are you just doing it because you're hating your job? You just want something else to do. So be brutally honest with yourself before you really dive in. Yeah. So I would advocate for folks that are, you know, in college and studying this kind of stuff is in anybody in general is go and work for firms, go and work for organizations, learn about their systems and processes, learn about the business. You want to learn about the craft. But again, I hate that I keep using athlete examples, but there's a difference between being a basketball player, able to play basketball, and being a professional athlete, right? And the professional athlete includes the media. It includes, you know, the nutrition, the training, like that kind of thing. There are things that are involved around being a professional athlete that doesn't necessarily just mean that you're a good basketball player. And that, so if I relate that to say, you know, just because you were good managing your own money and you paid off debt or, you know, like you have a great money story yourself, does not mean that you are a good financial coach, right? And so understanding and unpacking that and learning to become a good financial coach, it could happen. You can learn to become, it is a skill to develop, but that is going to take time as you develop it. So it's not something that happens overnight, as you were saying.
Well, I so enjoyed the conversation with Wilson. As you can tell, he has a great body of knowledge. Tell you what, if you liked this podcast or have some comments about the path of financial coaching versus financial advising, or if you know you learned something new today that is helping you decide your path, please leave that down in the comment. Share it with somebody that is thinking about this career or that you know this may be helpful for. I'm also going to have in the cards or over here to the side that you can check out some more conversations in finance with some other guests that give a wealth of perspective on the financial services industry. Thanks for watching. We'll see you later. Bye-bye. Well, that wraps up this week's episode, and I hope you were able to glean at least one takeaway that will help you on your path. You know what? I'd really love to hear what it was that I said that may have helped you. Feel free to drop me an email at info@djh-capital.com. That's info@djh-capital.com. One last thing, my friend. It would really help the podcast if you would leave a review on the platform that you're enjoying it on. I'd really appreciate it, and it will help more financial professionals like yourself find out about what we're doing here. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.